Just by way of introduction, I'm Joe Hollander, Chair of the Palmerston North Defence Heritage Advisory Group and the Engineer Charitable Trust. And we co-host these sessions with the Palmerston North City Library and in particular the Heritage Team. Those of you who attended our last presentation last month, that was to observe the 75th anniversary of the formation of the United Nations. Beth Greener from Massey University presented to us, talking about New Zealand's position with the United Nations, focusing a little bit on peacekeeping and so on. And so we're delighted today to have one of our regular speakers back with us, David Leadsom, retired Rear Admiral, ex-Chief of Navy, Royal New Zealand Navy, to talk to us about a very interesting peacekeeping mission in 1990 entitled Soldiers Without Guns. Although the soldiers were watery type soldiers, weren't they, Dave?
The correct title is Soldiers Without Guns, Part 1.
Yeah, because next year we're going to have Part 2. All right, so welcome, David, and I'll leave it over to you.
Thanks, Joe.
Thanks.
Before I start, I'd just like to acknowledge Colin White, who's here from Wellington, who was on the operation with me in Waikato. So why talk about big talk? My initial rationale for talking about Operation Big Talk was the realisation that while it was important for me to keep alive naval stories from the past, and I see that as an obligation I have as having served, especially those who served in the World Wars, Korea and confrontation, that obligation should not be discharged necessarily at the exclusion of stories from my own 42 years in the Navy. Because I'd hate to think that I spent 42 years in the Navy being born for social duties only. And it was especially important, I thought, to shine a light on the operational activities undertaken by the Royal New Zealand Navy in that time in which we were given the Navy no space in the national memory, especially the Cold War years, and no medal to pin on a uniform to recognise the unrecognised time sailors spent away from home on first 18, then 12, followed by 9, and then 6 month deployments. I have mentioned previously in this forum the idea that wars are fought twice, first on the battlefield and then in the national memory. In the case of this country, the Navy, and I include the Merchant Navy in this point, despite participating in the first battle on the battlefield, seems to have not turned up for the second in the national memory. As I thought about how I might approach putting together a presentation, the film Soldiers Without Guns and its perspective on the Truce Monitoring Group in Bougainville in between November 1997 and May 1998 emerged in this context as an irritating itch. The coverage in that film and in various books and academic papers seemed to me to add yet more threads to the overall khaki colour of the national tapestry of New Zealand's military efforts overseas since the South African War between 1899 and 1902, and at a greater density than was merited. So, as I read about Soldiers Without Guns and noted the absence of Operation Big Talk, as I read the book Doves Over the Pacific, In Pursuit of Peace and Stability in Bougainville, which contains around 32 pages on Operation Big Talk, and as I reflected on my own experiences in Bougainville as a commanding officer of HMNZS Waikato, I thought it timely that the story about the Navy's 1990 peace mission in Bougainville should be given a brief opportunity to emerge from out of the darkness. To set the context for my talk, Here are three slides with comment on Soldiers Without Guns, which are followed by one disclosing a contrary view. Next one. And the final one. So just now, in terms of setting the scene, recount some facts about Bougainville. Where is it? It's its location. And there's the island. Bougainville lies on the eastern edge of Papua New Guinea. It's a large island, about 200 kilometres long and varying between 60 kilometres and 100 kilometres wide. Hook Up, which you can see up the top there, a small island at its northern tip, is also considered part of Bougainville. The capital is Arawa, here, located on the eastern coast. The people are mostly Melanesian, but many identify more with the Solomon Islanders, known colloquially as Black Skins, than they do with mainland Papua New Guineans, who are referred to as Redskins. The current population of around 300,000 is ethnically and linguistically diverse. There are about 21 distinct languages on the island. Early history of Bougainville. Bougainville was named for the French explorer Louis de Bougainville, a contemporary of James Cook, who sighted it in 1768. In 1884, the German colonial administration in Rabaul annexed Bougainville, and in 1899, Britain and Germany separated Bougainville from the Solomon Islands, thus arbitrarily dividing ethnically similar peoples into two jurisdictions. Bougainville later became a province of German New Guinea, and then after the First World War, the League of Nations granted Australia a mandate to govern the German territory in New Guinea, including Bougainville. So as I sort of think about what I'm just saying, it's quite often to forget that much of the Pacific was colonised by European countries, including, of course, our own. After the Second World War, during which ferocious fighting between Japanese and Allied forces, including New Zealanders, took place on Bougainville, all of Papua New Guinea became part of the United Nations International Trusteeship System administered by Australia. Papua New Guinea finally became independent from Australia on 16 September 1975. However, prior to this, local leaders on Bougainville made Bougainville's first unilateral declaration of independence on the 1st of September 1975. The declaration was ignored by both the outgoing Australian administration and the incoming Papua New Guinea one, but it was a clear expression of Bougainville's desire for self-determination. Just digressing, it's quite interesting when I have a great affection for Papua New Guinea, and you look at the impact of the Australian administration of Papua New Guinea. And I remember going to visit a building, and I thought the building was being renovated. Curtains were falling down, panels out of the ceiling, darkness, scuffed carpet, total mess. It was the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. But the Australians had built massive buildings withdrawn from Papua New Guinea and then expected the locals to find the money to maintain them. And that's what colonial powers do. They create infrastructure and they create a boom. And an interesting insight to me from Papua New Guinea was Papua New Guinea Chief of Defence Force said to me, "We need Australia, we want New Zealand." So New Zealand does in fact have a special relationship into the Pacific. Right, sorry for digressing. The origins of the Bougainville Crisis. So it's called various things: the Bougainville Crisis, the Bougainville War, the Bougainville Conflict, the Bougainville Crisis. In 1964, a huge copper and gold deposit was discovered near the centre of Bougainville, and from it emerged the Bougainville Copper Limited's Panguna mine, which commenced operations on the 1st of April 1972. That's a shot of the mine, and hopefully it gives you an idea of the size of the thing. The mine was a massive, complex operation, an exceptionally rugged terrain that required a great deal of expatriate engineering and mining expertise. Nevertheless, the company had a commitment to create indigenous employment and to train locals to take over from expatriates. However, the mine owner's attempts to be a responsible corporate citizen were challenged by the sheer size of the mine. This is another shot of it. Far bigger than any mine in Australia. It could not be dug without the displacement of villages and removal of soil that washed down steep mountain valleys into rivers that became dead zones. It could not be built without thousands of outsiders, most of whom were men who dominated the local space, who consumed too much alcohol, harassed local women, and created a fear that the local culture, laws, and identity were being swept aside. There was, however, an upside. The mine's management spent significant amounts of money on social services and infrastructure on the island. Bougainvillians employed at the mine learned trade skills and were offered scholarships for further education. Many Bougainvillians used the skills learnt at the mine and other businesses in Arawa to find employment elsewhere in Papua New Guinea, Australia, and beyond. By the 1980s, Bougainville was considered among the most advanced and wealthiest provinces in Papua New Guinea. The Arawa area in which the Panguna mine was located had a well-equipped hospital, schools, and roads, and had the second highest per capita income of all Papua New Guinea provinces. It produced 14% of the national income and half of its exports. Life expectancy, infant mortality, and educational indicators were all substantially superior to the national average. However, discontentment with the mine and its associated issues persisted on Bougainville. By 1988, a new younger group of militant landowners led by Francis Ona, a former mine employee, set up a breakaway landowner group, the New Panguna Landowners Association, and placed what were commercially unrealistic demands on the mine owners. That's Francis Ona. A number of aggregating factors, including the profits from the mine, were not being sufficiently repatriated for the development of Bougainville. Local landholders were not being compensated adequately, and tailings from the mine that were dumped into a local river were blamed for causing birth defects and killing local wildlife, reached the point where Ona and a former Papua New Guinea Defence Force Army Lieutenant Sam Kawona felt so aggrieved that they resorted to violent action. On 1 December 1988, they were involved in the blowing up of a power transmission tower. The mine was closed briefly and a curfew declared. Through 1989, the violence continued, and in March, a Bougainvillean woman was killed by migrant workers, two mainlanders were killed in payback, and some soldiers were killed in an ambush. The concept of payback in Papua New Guinea is an interesting one. I think it's quite similar to the Maori principle of utu. The first time I came across a phrase was when we visited Port Moresby in 1975. This was also HMNZS Waikato. And the local New Zealand representative army officer came out to the ship and said to us, before you go ashore, you need to understand the concept of payback. He said, here's an example. Recently, some men from one village went to another village and raped women. Men from that village went to that village that had raped their women and raped men. So it's revenge, but revenge in kind. And it's a pretty strong motivating factor in a lot of the relationships in Papua New Guinea. On 15 May 1989, the mine was closed and still remains closed. On 26 June, a state of emergency was declared on Bougainville. The government sent in the police and eventually the Defence Force. At one time, there were 2,000 security forces on Bougainville. But they proved ineffective against the guerrilla tactics employed by the militants, who called themselves the Bougainville Revolutionary Army, the BRA. In September, a government minister was assassinated in his village. At the start of 1990, the ground shifted. In January, the national government was forced to make a 25% cut in national government expenditures and to devalue the currency by 10%. Its patience with Bougainville reached its end. On 4 January, Prime Minister Namaliu announced the government had ceased all attempts at peaceful negotiations with the militants on Bougainville and was adopting an all-military option. Over the next 2 months, bitter fighting ensued with casualties for both sides, totalling over 100 dead. This period included the so-called St. Valentine's Day Massacre, when on 14 February, the bodies of 5 Bougainvillians who had been executed by the Defence Force were dropped at sea from a Defence Force's Iroquois helicopter. In early February, hundreds of expatriates, government and plantation workers were evacuated to Rabaul and Port Moresby. The state of emergency was extended and an international peace negotiator was accepted by both sides, and he managed to persuade the Bougainville Revolutionary Army to lay down their arms in exchange for the government withdrawing security forces. Both sides agreed to hold talks, and on the 2nd of March, a ceasefire took effect. The Bougainville Revolutionary Army agreed to disarm under the supervision of an international observers group. The government had agreed to a withdrawal of all Defence Force personnel, but that 70 police officers would remain on Bougainville. Instead, the government official in charge of the state of emergency ordered a hasty retreat not only of the military, but also of all police, who before departing set all prisoners free, contributing to the Rascal, that's organised crime gang's problem that took over the province. Following official criticism of his actions, the official really dug a hole for himself when he unsuccessfully tried to overthrow the government by arresting the Prime Minister. In any event, his decision left the army, the island, in control of the Bougainville Revolutionary Army. The International Observers Group, which had been agreed to, arrived in Bougainville just as the government forces were leaving. And after 4 days of work, they concluded that the opinion of the group is that both parties have abided by their pledge of good faith in the ceasefire agreement, thereby creating conditions for negotiations to commence at the earliest possible opportunity, close quotes. However, the Bougainville Revolutionary Army did not actually disarm and instead took control of the island. On 2nd of May, the Papua New Guinea government, the cabinet, declared war on the Revolutionary Army and ordered a total blockade on government services and supplies to Bougainville, as well as imposing an explosion zone in which any unauthorised vessel would be fired upon without notice. It was enforced using Iroquois helicopters and Pacific-class patrol boats that had been supplied to Papua New Guinea as aid by the Australian government in the late 1980s. The result was the closure of hospitals, shops, banks, schools, shipping and air transport. Soon there were no phones, electricity, oil or petrol, and the provincial government disbanded. What gradually became apparent was that the most devastating aspect of the blockade for the lives of ordinary bougainvilleans was that it included a blockade of medical supplies. It is estimated that 5% of the population of Bougainville died during the blockade due to a lack of medicines and food. On 17 May, Ona responded by proclaiming a unilateral declaration of independence and announcing the formation of an interim government of the Republic of Bougainville, chaired by the former Premier Joseph Kabui. However, the interim government and the Bougainville Revolutionary Army were unable to maintain any sort of order, and the province suffered a general economic and political collapse. This is Joseph Kabui. A number of rascal gangs that were affiliated with the Bougainville Revolutionary Army, equipped largely with weapons salvaged from the fighting of World War II, terrorised villages, engaging in murder, rape and pillage. Bougainville split into several factions as the conflict took on ethnic and separatist characteristics. Support for the Bougainville Revolutionary Army declined and a Bougainville resistance force emerged, formed of locals who largely collaborated with the Papua New Guinea Defence Force, often to seek payback against the Bougainville Revolutionary Army, even if many of them wanted independence too. Bougainvillians described this period as one of violent anarchy, and that was the context out of which Operation Big Talk emerged. Operation Big Talk. So I have to admit, as I was preparing that bit, I'm glad I didn't know a lot of that before we went there. That Operation Big Talk happened was the unintended result of two things coming together. The cancellation of planned negotiations between the Papua New Guinea government and the Bougainville interim government. And at that time, early June 1990, the presence in Papua New Guinea of a New Zealand South Pacific Policy Review Group, which gave the Papua New Guinea government the idea that New Zealand could assist in facilitating negotiations. The interim government and the Revolutionary Army had demanded that if there was to be any future opportunity for negotiations with the Papua New Guinea government, then the talks must be held on neutral grounds and facilitated by neutral observers. So in late June 1990, Commodore Ian Hunter, who was the fleet commander of the Royal New Zealand Navy at that time, was advised by the Chief of Navy that he would command Operation Big Talk as Commander Task Force 650. So when the military do operations, they set up a structure. Generally, it will be called a task force, and there will be task groups, which are various elements under it. So Commodore Hunter was actually commander Task Force 650. Task Group 650.1 was the Navy contribution, and he was in command of that. So we'll touch on that later in the story. So Commodore Hunter, commander Task Force 650, with a senior Ministry of Foreign Affairs official who was fluent in Pidgin as his political advisor. The task force would include Waikato frigate, Wellington the frigate, and Endeavour the tanker. Those ships were at that time in Singapore for a five-power defence arrangements exercise. Now, the five-power defence arrangement is a formal agreement between UK, Australia, New Zealand, Singapore, and Malaysia, that if military action is taken against either Singapore or Malaysia, they will come together to resolve it. So its whole purpose really was to keep peace between Singapore and Malaysia. So we were in Singapore for exercise Starfish and partway through a planned deployment up into Southeast Asia. The concept of operations was that Endeavour would provide a neutral venue for the talks and the frigates would be used for transport and accommodation as required. In early July, Commodore Hunter flew to Singapore to brief the three commanding officers on the operation, one of which was me. Now, I thought to add a bit of context, my first wife, she died in 1994, but she kept all the letters that we exchanged with each other while I was at sea. So I thought, I'll just see if there's anything in the suitcase, and blow me down, top of the suitcase were two letters from that time. So I thought they might just add a personal touch to the presentation. So the first one is dated the 10th of July. So this, hi darling. Over the hectic past few days, I had a really bad moment the other night. It was after sunset, and with three other ships, we were doing approaches on Endeavour. We had just finished one approach and were moving into a new station when Endeavour altered course straight towards us. I altered course hard to port and immediately increased speed to 24 knots. We passed about 24 knots in front of her bow. It was quite a frightening moment because had I delayed my actions by only 30 seconds, we would almost certainly have collided. The exercise has been very interesting. 19 ships from Singapore, Malaysia, Britain, Australia, and New Zealand are participating, and we were made to work very hard doing gunnery and anti-submarine exercises. Tomorrow we all sail for the tactical phase. When the exercise finishes, we sail directly to Rabaul to pick up the Papua New Guinea delegation for the peace talks. Wellington leaves the exercise early for 2 days in Singapore and Endeavour for 8 hours. We all meet up on the 18th. So that's it. And then the next letter is the 15th of July. Endeavour arrived this morning to embark more fuel, and Wellington went in yesterday morning. They both sail tomorrow, and we will all meet up either tomorrow evening or Tuesday morning, heading for Bougainville. Our route takes us between the Philippines and Borneo. Waikato picks up the government delegation from Rabaul on 27 July, and Wellington the Bougainville delegation from Honiara the same day. When we meet up with Endeavour and head off for Bougainville, this is assuming, of course, that the talks go ahead. I must admit that I wanted to have the Bougainville people on board because I believe they would be the more interesting to talk to. The government delegation is supposed to be headed by Samari, who I will invite to dine with me in the evenings. I believe he has been Prime Minister of PNG. Speaking of which, I don't know whether I told you, Cole, this goes into some personal stuff, and then still no idea when we get home, because that depends on the talks. So I'm afraid it's a case of just wait and see. However, I still believe we will not be home late. Wellington definitely will be. And I'll include the next bit just to give you a sense of what actually it's like for sailors at sea when we get deployed on operations. By the way, Cole, if Dad dies while I'm away, which unfortunately seems more and more likely, I will not fly home. Also, I do not want you to feel you will have to attend the funeral. I know that, like me, you hate flying. Also, we both dislike funerals. Personally, I don't see the point of them for families. Anyway, the decision is yours, but I thought it important for you to know that there is no compulsion for you to attend the funeral, David. So they just give a sense of the mood, the the things that you go through and you think of when these things happen. Because this operation, like my other operation, Armilla, happened partway through a planned deployment to go somewhere else. So for Armilla, we were in Hawaii on our way to a West Coast deployment, away from home for 4.5 months or something. We were told, go to the Middle East and you get home after 9 months. And this was the same. We're on our way to Southeast Asia and we get told, no, 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 it's all changed. And that's just the way it is. So I will say that at the end of, just to lighten things, but at the end of the exercise, Starfish, we were heading into an island called Pulau Tioman, Waikato, and a Malaysian ship. And I said to the Malaysian ship, I'll race you to the anchorage. So we came up to 24 knots or something. They came up, and after a while, they chickened out. But we kept going, dropped our anchor. The next morning, I found out I'd been going too fast. I think it took us a couple of hours to extract it from the seabed. So, on completion of Exercise Starfish on 17 July, Waikato Endeavour sailed for Rabaul, where the Papua New Guinea government representatives and international observers would be embarked in Wellington. So, in the meantime, after I'd written my letters, the plan had changed. Wellington were going to pick up the government people, and Waikato was going to pick up the Bougainvilleans. And Commodore Hunter and his staff embark into Waikato. So he came on board as CTF 650, CTG 650.1, which I thought was not quite demonstrating a full understanding of the structure of task forces. Normally you split the command. I arrived on my bridge and said, sir, you are commander of the task group. Where do we go? And he said to his staff officers, come down to the captain's cabin. And he came up to the bridge and said, you're commander of the task group now. So I turned to my navigator and said, pull out the charts and let's head down to Rabaul. So off we went. So we, Endeavour and Waikato, rendezvoused with Wellington in the vicinity of the Philippines. Passage from Singapore to Rabaul took 10 days, all of them fortunately in good weather, which enabled us to get ready for whatever we were going to find in Bougainville. We had been told that some Papua New Guinea Defence Force people and some Bougainville Revolutionary Army people were opposed to the talks and may well seek to destabilise the talks by creating destabilising incidents. Commodore Hunter had also been advised by Joseph Kabui that he hoped that he could keep the BRA under control, but he could not guarantee it, and there were some elements of the BRA who might disrupt the talks. There were intelligence reports too that the Bougainville Revolutionary Army had two heavy machine guns that could be used to engage the ship's boats as they moved about the harbour. In any event, Wellington proceeded into Rabaul on 27 July, and the government delegation led by Sir Michael Somare, here's a snapshot of him from a local newspaper, and international observers, a total of about 14 people, embarked the following day into Wellington. Waikato, in the meantime, with Commodore Hunter on board, together with Endeavour, continued down to Bougainville, entering Kita Harbour on the morning of 28 July. That's a view of Kita Harbour. In view of the threat, several countermeasures were in place on board Waikato. The helicopter with the machine gun mounted was at immediate notice to launch. The ship's 50-caliber machine guns were loaded. The crews hidden out of sight. The ship's 4.5-inch gun was closed up with high explosive rounds in the gunhouse. We have now entered a really interesting part of the story, the part where my recollection of events differs from that of others who were present. They use phrases such as to uplift the Bougainville delegation. A sizeable crowd assembled on Kieta Wharf intent on welcoming rather than repelling their visitors. people kept out of sight to avoid becoming too personally involved at this stage. This portrayal represents one perspective. Mine was fuller of uncertainties, and the only certainty was that it was me and some of my sailors who had to go ashore and not others. So this is my recollection of the day that started with Waikato anchoring in Kiita Harbour and ended up with 40 representatives of the Bougainville delegation going on board both Waikato and Endeavour. I can't exactly remember when, but at some point late in the game, I was told I would be going ashore into Kiita Harbour, which was a total surprise to me because I didn't speak pidgin English for a start. So the ship was anchored and I was pacing around the, what we call the cabin officer's cabin flat, which is the area, like a vacant area in the middle of the officer's cabins and just after the captain's cabin, wondering what on earth I was going to do to persuade these people to carry on with the peace talks. And I mean, quite frankly, I had no idea. I'd never been trained or had any experience in how to proceed. I'm not aware that the threat was an issue. It was, how am I going to carry out this task of persuading these people to carry on with the peace talks? So I'm pacing around in the cabin flat. I smoked in those days, puffing on a fag, wondering what to do, and Commodore Hunter came out and said, "Isn't it about time you went ashore?" And I'm still wondering what to do. And then I realised that the people ashore would expect a whole lot of white people to come up onto the wharf. That would be their expectation. And I actually had a unique ability, probably unique in the world, that I could actually go ashore with the ship's Kapahaka group. And in my view, for me to step up the wharf and then be followed by the Kapahaka group would entirely change the dynamic on that wharf. It would be so unexpected. Totally change the dynamics at play. So that's what we did. And we went ashore, and going into the shore, I'm thinking, how the hell do you start a conversation with people who may not want to do what you want them to do for the mission to be successful? How's that engagement going to happen? Because the opening words were going to be the vital words. So I said something along the lines of, for someone who's trained to go to war, it really, really is a fantastic opportunity to come on a mission of peace. And the conversation and the events went from then. Now, why I'm a bit cynical about, you know, the recounting of the tale by other people is, clearly there was a threat. It could have all turned upside down. And I look back on it, you know, we had the helicopter all set to go, but I'm not sure we ever had agreed what signal would trigger the helicopter launching from the ship. So it was all a bit of a mess. Unfortunately, it didn't go too badly. But I found out later that those Bougainvillean people thought that we were going to get them on board Waikato and immediately sail to Port Moresby, where they would be hanged for treason. So that was the mood, you know, that they had. Those were the reservations. And that's the scale of the success of Waikato's intervention on the wharf. So I was feeling pretty chuffed, got back on board Waikato, went to my cabin to find the Commodore and the Foreign Affairs person having a lovely lunch in my cabin, and said, "It's been successful, they'll come on board." To be, you meet with the response of, "Well done." That's life in a blue suit. So that's my memory of the day. The next day, 29 July, Waikato and Wellington rendezvoused with Endeavour about 12 miles off the coast of Bougainville, transferred their embarked delegations, that's the government and Bougainvillean delegations in the helicopters, and thus began the first day of the peace talks. That evening, Waikato's WASP transferred a seriously ill woman to Wellington, and then she was evacuated to Green Island. Turns out one of the main causes of death at the time during the blockade was women dying because they had fetuses that had died in the uterus, and there's no way of dealing with that. So the routine is, if we got a request for a medical evacuation, we had to ask Samari, because he represents the Papua New Guinea government, could we do the evacuation? And on both two occasions, it came in quite late at night, so it was quite heavy flying for the helicopter pilot. As I said, that was the first, and then the next day there was another evacuation of someone. 31st of July, 2 days later, both delegations agreed to conduct the negotiations in Kedah Harbour, so there was no need for us to go to sea and to be transferred to Endeavour by way of ship's boats. On completion of that day's talks, the Bougainville delegation asked for an adjournment until 2 August to consult with the Bougainville Revolutionary Army reps who were not attending the talks. Later in the evening, Waikato's WASP transferred a man with serious gunshot wounds back to the ship, and we transited overnight to Rabaul. So that was a request. We got some gunshot wounds. Can you take them to Rabaul for medical aid? Asked Samari, and he dilly-dallied for quite some time. I think from memory it was about 9 o'clock in the evening. And it was quite a hairy flight because there were power lines and stuff around. So we got him to into Rabaul, just about to sail back to Bougainville, and a stretcher arrives with a body of a Bougainvillean chap. They wanted the body to go back to Bougainville. And this was one of the hardest parts, as I've mentioned. You know, we would have wanted to do it, but we could not compromise our relationship with the Papua New Guinea government. And there was a blockade in force, and so the answer was, we will not do it. And that's just the way it was. So we got back to Kedah on the 2nd of August in time for talks to resume, and that was a bad day for the peace talks. On the 3rd of August, after an optimistic start, the talks broke down early in the day, and Wellington sailed overnight to Rabaul with the delegations embarked. The day off on 4th of August was clearly worthwhile. When talks resumed on 5 August, they ended at 6 p.m. with the delegation signing what was called the Endeavour Accord. Very shortly afterwards, Wellington's helicopter delivered 2 tonnes of medical supplies to the local hospital, and this was a relief to all. As I mentioned, one of the most difficult things we had to do while at anchor in Kedah was to ensure we did nothing to compromise the government's blockade. Local people would come out to the ships and boats and canoes asking for medicines and food. As hard as it was, we always said no. But I always remember an occasion when, I think it was Joseph Kabui mentioned it was his daughter's birthday or something. I loved little marzipan mice, sweets. My wife used to send me them, and I said to him, would you like one of these for your daughter for her birthday? And he said no. He actually died of a heart disease because he said the medication was too expensive. So that's the sort of guy Joseph Kabui was. Wellington sailed immediately for Rabaul. Waikato Endeavour departed about 8:30. The next day we were advised at 4 p.m. that Operation Big Talk had concluded. And after a quick chat, the commanding officers agreed to sail at once for New Zealand, arriving home 8 days later, bringing to an end 42 days continuously at sea for Waikato and Endeavour. On the way home, there was one light-hearted moment, at least that I recall, which I'll recount just to lighten the mood a bit. So I'm not a religious person, I'm agnostic, but the commanding officer of Wellington, his father was a Presbyterian minister, so he lives in a different space. We had a padre on board Waikato. The padre was on board Waikato. The commanding officer of Wellington sent me a signal saying, can I borrow your padre to conduct a church service tomorrow? And I sent a signal back saying, yes, of course you can borrow the padre. He sent a signal back to me saying, I will dispatch my helicopter to pick him up at 10 a.m. in the morning. I send him a signal back saying, helicopter not required, Padre will walk. As Reuben Bowd, he's an Australian Army officer, records in his book Doves Over the Pacific, the euphoria of homecoming, however, soon dissipated with news of New Zealand's potential involvement in the Persian Gulf following news of Iraq's invasion of Kuwait on 2 August. Events in the Persian Gulf overshadowed the achievements of Operation Big Talk, and this successful operation was unjustifiably relegated to the dustbin of forgotten deployments. Responses to the Endeavour Accord. So here's, first one is from a Papua New Guinea government. You can see what it says there. Peace at last. Most difficult negotiations in my life. Financial review. One of the most important agreements to be signed in Papua New Guinea since independence. Another comment. The signing of the Endeavour Accord was a miraculous breakthrough. New Zealand Prime Minister Mr. Palmer said New Zealand could take some credit for the peaceful resolution. And in New Zealand's Parliament, from the government, I seek to move, compliments of the Royal New Zealand Navy ships, Mr. Tony Brown, for their work, and the opposition, now Sir Don McKinnon. The opposition is naturally delighted the New Zealand Navy had fleet to make that possible. All that New Zealand did, in the words of the Minister of External Relations and Trade, was put out the chairs and make cucumber sandwiches. What is that song by, quite like a reggae group, You Diss Me and I'll Diss You? Right. So those of us involved in Operation Big Talk were awarded Chief of Navy commendations printed on an A4 piece of paper. Most of us, I think, didn't keep them for very long. Almost 30 years after the operation, it was decided that the participants would be awarded an Operational Service Medal. Well, this was a long time to wait for recognition like that. It is very short compared to the almost 70 years the World War II veterans of the Russian convoys waited for the institution of the Arctic Star to recognise their service. Well, the OSM was a meaningless decision, really, for those of us who were already qualified for that medal. For those who were without one, there was a very well-deserved and overdue recognition that in their Navy service they had, in fact, done operations. The journey to peace after Big Talk. The Papua New Guinea government sought to use the Endeavour Accord to resurrect its authority in the province. But the attempt to infiltrate troops back into the province in September 1990 so angered the Bougainville leadership that the follow-up peace talks set out in the Endeavour Accord for September-October did not materialise until 22 January 1991. In April 1991, troops returned to areas of the provinces and fighting resumed between the Bougainville Revolutionary Army and the Papua New Guinea Defence Force. There were follow-on conferences in 1993, 1994 and 1995. All failed. In June 1996, Papua New Guinea's military offensive on Bougainville ended dismally in the Kangu Beach Massacre. 12 Defence Force and police personnel were killed and 5 taken hostage. This catastrophe so angered the Prime Minister, Sir Julius Chan, that he entered into secret negotiations with Sandline International, an international security company, to contract a mercenary force to fight the Bougainville Revolutionary Army. When this plan was publicly denounced by the Papua New Guinea Chief of Defence Force and criticised by Australia, New Zealand, and other Pacific Island nations, the Sandline contract was suspended and the opportunity for further peace negotiations was created. And this led to the Burnham Accord and the Truce Monitoring Group. The subject of Soldiers Without Guns, Part 2. Over the 10 violent years of the Bougainville crisis, an estimated 7,600 to 10,000 people died in armed skirmishes, payback vendettas, and due to disease, lack of medical facilities, hunger, and exposure. The number of actual combat deaths between the two Bougainville Revolutionary factions and Papua New Guinea Defence Forces is unclear, but may have been between 1,000 and 2,000 lives. Bougainville today. In 2019, in a non-binding referendum, 98% of Bougainvillians voted for independence from Papua New Guinea. However, the result has to be ratified by Papua New Guinea's national government to come into effect, and Bougainville does not automatically become an independent country. Its government has to negotiate the terms of separation from Papua New Guinea. The process could take months or even years, and right now things on the island look bleak. In a statement on 17 June this year, the president of the autonomous region of Bougainville said, "The recent spate of violent acts and the general deterioration of law and order in Bougainville can no longer be ignored. I condemn the recent senseless acts of murder and arson related to sorcery and payback killings that has happened in the last couple of weeks throughout parts of Bougainville. People have assumed that they are a law unto themselves, where they are judge, jury, and executioner. These actions have now forced the government to introduce sterner measures to deal with lawbreakers who continue to impede development and our journey to political independence." Now we go to Soldiers Without Guns.
Sorry, Sailors Without Guns.
So this is, it actually turns out there was a sailor from HMNS Waikato who followed the journey ashore with a video camera and took a video of the sailors on the wharf, the Kapahaka group performing on the wharf. So to me it's important that this is able to be presented as evidence that the Navy did it first. So these are the local people on the wharf observing and doing a dance. This is one of the members of the ship's Kapahaka group wearing the old Waikato rugby colours. Well, in those days, we didn't have... I'm not sure we actually had cover and Maori stuff. Yeah, they wanted... Yeah.
Oh, God.
I'll stop it there. So just listening to that. If you could just imagine that, to look at that, I think you get a, in that context, you get a really deep sense of what it is to be a New Zealander, and an understanding that no other nation in the world could have created that circumstance. None. And so, I always say, those who have the greatest love of this country are those who spend time away from it. And so, right, so just the epilogue. So if anyone wants to watch that video, you just go onto YouTube and put Waikato and Bougainville. So this is an excerpt from Doves Over the Pacific. And I just provide this as a perspective. And I don't know how many of you, if you get into the situation where you're preparing something or writing something and some rhyme or poem just slips into your brain without you even thinking about it. And as I was doing this, this skipped into my brain without me calling it forward. It's the difference between the Navy and the rest. In my view. So that completes the presentation. Thank you very much.
A fascinating presentation. I'm sure we've got time for a couple of questions. Are there any questions? Yeah, Peter.
Clearly, do you think the Bougainville people have done historical disservice by being lumped into the PNG?
Well, I mean, I just look at a map, and clearly they fit into the Solomon Islands. So the answer is yes.
And maybe PNG were keen on them because of the vibe.
I think it was the result of decisions made by colonial powers, you know, who decided to draw lines on maps irrespective of the demographic or ethno whatever reality that was there. Yes. It's really sad. It's just quite clearly part of the same entity. Richard?
Yeah, just a logistics point, I guess. You've got a frigate with 250 sailors aboard. I know full well, but others will probably appreciate, the frigate is not a cruise ship. There are not spare cabins. Where do you accommodate your party of whatever it was, 40 or so from ashore?
Well, that was Wellington's problem. I think they were in the chief's mess. Yeah. We didn't have a problem in Waikato because we picked them up from shore.
Oh, each time. So you.
Yeah, but it was an issue for Wellington, but they were in one of the chief's messes, I understand.
Yeah.
So that's a send around mess.
Any other questions? No. All right, I know we're getting. Oh, sorry. Did the Mercury walk on water?
Of course he did. What do you think the answer is? All padres walk on water,
regardless of denomination.
Oh, well, look, thanks very much, David. Thanks. I'm sorry about the. We've had a wee problem with this particular screen before. Unfortunately, and we've. If you recall, we missed out on a couple of other presentation clips. Look, I'd just like to take the opportunity to thank David in particular, sharing some of those personal aspects as well, which I think is important, because unless you've served, a lot of people in the community don't understand what it is like to serve or be away from home and the stresses and strains of deploying, regardless of where it is, on the family. And the impact that that has on family. But it also brings through other aspects of, you know, why Kiwis do so well in an international environment. It doesn't matter whether it's in the Pacific or in the Northern Hemisphere or wherever. We always seem to be able to bring out that empathy. And just the way we are, the way we've been trained, the way we've been brought up, educated and so on. And I think that's that's very important. So thanks for doing that, David. Yeah. Thanks for sharing that. And thanks, Virginia, for the library team.